Well, let's go over there to the book of Habakkuk. I don't know whether you have trouble saying that word or not. It seems like somehow I have difficulty getting it out every now and then. I don't know whether it's got too many K's for me or what. It's just an odd pronunciation for our English language. Problem could be that it was originally a Hebrew word. And you may not know it, but the original Hebrew did not have any vowels. No vowels in the original Hebrew. Can you imagine the problem that the translators must have had? Can you imagine the problem that people must have had trying to pronounce the words for the first time? A lot of people don't know that one of the first vowel systems that was ever invented, little diacritical markings to go with the Hebrew, was put out by a Baptist preacher, John Gill. He was the first one, so far as I know, that ever came out with a Hebrew vowel system. That was in the 1700s. But anyway, we have it in our English form, and we call it Habakkuk. That's what we'll keep calling it the best we can. We ended last time at the fourth verse. The first four verses primarily had to do with the great problem that Habakkuk had as to why God didn't do something. He looked around him and the world was in a mess. His nation was in a state of apostasy and spiritual declension. And he said, there's violence that fills the land. Everything's gone to the bad. God, why don't you do something? Why don't you judge people for all these wicked acts that they're guilty of? And he was troubled because God had not done anything about all the sin that seemed to abound and superabound in the kingdom of Judah. And so what we really have here, beginning in the fifth verse, and I think all the way down to the 11th verse, you have God answering the complaint of the prophet. And I told you in the beginning that this is more or less, in the first two chapters, a dialogue between God and the prophet. The prophet raises questions and God comes back and he answers these questions. Maybe sometimes we wished he would do us that way. Maybe we ask the questions and he doesn't give any immediate answer in the manner that he did to the prophet. But back in the time when this book was written, it was really not uncommon for God almost to speak directly to individuals, especially prophets and spiritual men of that time of the Old Testament. So the essence of what we have in verse 5 all the way down to verse 11 is that man does not understand God. That's the first problem that Habakkuk needs to come to grasp with. The Lord tells him that a finite man just simply cannot understand what God's doing in the world. So that simply means that you and I are incompetent judges of what God's doing in His providential control of the world. Sometimes it may seem to us that it's all run aground, so to speak. That it's all turned out for the worse. But it really hasn't, because God is doing everything like He wants to do it. And in true faith, we must believe that. So the Lord is going to answer the prophet, and really the first thing He's going to point out is a truth that's better stated in another book of the Bible, and that is that God's ways are not man's ways. There's a statement in the book of Isaiah in the 55th chapter that I believe really is a basic statement about God. And it tells us how that, of course, the Lord's ways are not our ways. Listen to verse 8 and 9 of Isaiah 55. God is speaking here, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." So we're not competent judges of God. We don't know much about running the world. Most of us have enough problem running our own household, running our own lives. And can you imagine what a responsibility would be in compassed in governing the whole world. So he said, don't be too quick, Habakkuk, to judge my providence, because you don't understand what I'm doing anyway. And he proceeds to tell him, though, what he's going to do. So he answers the complaint, especially there, beginning in verse 5. Behold ye among the heathen, and regard and wonder marvelously, for I will work a work in your days, which ye will not believe, though it be told you. So this is a rather comprehensive statement. It's quoted in Acts 13:41 and applied there to the unbelieving Israelites in the days of Paul and Christ. But it certainly had an application to Judah at this particular time. It seems to me that the Lord is beginning to reason like this with the prophet. He said, what do you mean? You don't understand why I don't do something. Don't you know right now that I'm raising up the army of the Chaldeans to come over here and invade Judah and punish them in this generation for their sins? And so God announces there in verse 5 and 6 that he's going to send the enemy to punish Israel, to correct Judah of her sins. And I honestly believe that God oftentimes does this. I sometimes look at the awful condition of the world today and I ask the question, is God using communism, socialism, humanism, and Catholicism to correct his churches? And the answer is probably yes. It's probably yes. I think that would be answered in the affirmative. He begins by saying, behold ye among the heathen. As if to say, all of you heathens, pay attention to what I'm going to do. There's going to be a public punishment of my people, Judah. You know, one of the things that God warned Israel about early in the beginning of their nation, even in the days of Moses, back there in Genesis 28, verse 24 and 25, if they didn't obey God, they would fall before the enemy. That was one of the things God said he'd do to punish them for their sins. He said, you'll be smitten by your enemies. Well, we're about to see that take place. And so the way that it starts off there, behold ye among the heathen, wonder and all of that. The idea is that the judgment of God upon Judah is going to be heavier than he would send upon Babylon or Egypt or some other ancient nation of that day. Now the word wonder marvelously in the Hebrew is peculiar. It's really a double word. I'd probably translate it be amazed, or be astonished. That's really the idea. And so it expresses amazement that follows amazement. And so there's going to be something that will shock and astonish people. It'll even be a terror and a dread, because of what God's going to do. Even the heathens can hardly believe their ears and eyes as to how severely God is going to judge Judah. So the prophet is more or less being told by God, what do you mean I'm not doing anything? I've been working all along. You just didn't know it. And certainly it's going to be the work of the Lord. Now the Babylonians are going to do the invading, but God works through even the enemies of his people when it pleases him to do so. He said, I will work a work. So, well, the Babylonians are going to do the dirty work. They're going to rape the women and burn the town and steal everybody's money. That's true, but God is bringing that nation to judge Judah for their sins. So God was not inactive like the prophet thought. He said, I will work a work. He said, I'm working right now. I'm working out my plan. You just don't know it, Habakkuk. And so he was about to do something, and he was going to do it very soon, because he said, for I will work a work in your days. Right now, very soon, it's going to be done. Don't say I'm not doing anything. I'm very soon to show you what I'm going to do. And so the way that reads there, when he said, ye will not believe it, though it be told you, as if a man would have to see it to believe it. If you just went up and told him that all of these people would come and all these bad things would happen to Judah, the average man on the street would have probably said, oh no, that could never happen to us. And so the Lord said, what I'm going to do is almost unbelievable. It is so awful, it is so terrible, until you won't believe it, until you see it take place before your own eyes. You know, that's a problem with people, whether in the Old Testament or the New. They don't believe God. They don't believe the judgment that He threatens. Men never believe that God is in earnest until His judgment actually comes upon them. Noah was a preacher of righteousness, but he didn't get many converts during that nearly 100 years that he preached and built that ark. Old Lot went around in Sodom and told his son-in-laws and other people that the town was going to burn, get out, but nobody wanted to go. You see how that even though people are warned of judgment coming, that they don't listen? And right now, the men of God are preaching that there's going to come upon this earth an awful 7-year tribulation period, worse than anything that's ever been or ever shall be hereafter. But the average man don't believe it. But he will when it comes to pass. But not many will until it actually does come to pass. Then we go on down and we have more particular information here about how the Chaldeans are going to invade in verse 6. They're mentioned by name and God is said to be raising up this army. For lo, I raise up the Chaldeans. You want to know why that low and mean group of people became a mighty nation? The answer is very clear here. God raised them up. It's strange that He did when you think about the kind of people they were. Because they were known for their soothsaying, their divination and astrology. In other words, to put it blunt, for devil worship. They worship demons. And the seat of idolatry has always been Babylon. The Bible predicts that, and the Bible proves that to be so. And what we have today is a lot of revival of Babylonianism in our world. And it plainly says here, though, that God raised up these Chaldeans. He raised them up by His providence. That's exactly what the Lord said He would do if His people didn't obey Him. In Deuteronomy 28, 49, and 50, He made some very scary predictions over there about what He was going to do if the people didn't obey Him. Let's go back and look at some of that. Really sometime read that whole 28th chapter of Deuteronomy, and you'll find out that God threatened Israel with much that actually happened to them. Let's read 49 and 50 there. The Lord shall bring a nation against thee. Now God's going to send that nation. People say, well, that's an accident. No, the Bible said the Lord brought them. The Lord shall bring a nation against thee from far, from the end of the earth, as swift as an eagle flieth, a nation whose tongue thou shalt not understand. They didn't understand the Chaldean tongue. A nation of fierce countenance, which shall not regard the person of the old, nor show favor to the young. Well, that's a pretty good description of the Babylonians. And it was given by Moses hundreds of years before this time. So God's about to do exactly what He said that He was going to do. And in Jeremiah 5 and 15, He said He would bring a strong nation against Judah. That's exactly what He said He's going to do there in this sixth verse. So this nation is being raised up. These Chaldeans are being raised up under God's providence. So let's read all the verse. For lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess the dwelling places that are not theirs. So God said, I'm going to do it. Now we're going to ask the question here, and this verse really already has answered it. We're going to look at two other verses. does a holy God at times raise up a wicked nation to punish his own people? The answer is yes.
Amen.
It's seen in this text. But look back at another statement, even plainer. Sometimes, you know, you wonder why that God allowed a man like old Pharaoh to live, that made all those Israelites slaves and made them have to make the bricks and go gather their own straw and all this stuff. And all this oppression that they had while they were in Egypt. Why did God let a man like that come on the scene? You ever wondered about that? Why did he let a man like Hitler come along years ago? Why has he got a man now like Fidel Castro down in Cuba and Gorbachev over in Russia? And on we could go. Why does God allow all these wicked men to live? You ever wondered about that? Well, you'll find the answer in Exodus chapter 9 and verse 16. It's the best answer that can be given, too. And in very deed, for this cause have I raised thee up. God speaking about Pharaoh. For to show in thee my power, and that my name might be declared throughout the earth. So God allows wicked nations in his providence to be raised up that they might punish his people for their sins. Really, over there in Revelation 17 and 17, when it talks about the ten kings that are going to give their power to the Antichrist and who will destroy the world church, the great whore, it is said that God put it in their hearts to do this. Listen to Revelation 17, 17. For God has put it in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and to give their kingdom unto the beast until the word of God shall be fulfilled. So the answer to our question, does God use an evil nation to punish his people, is yes. He did in the days of Habakkuk, and we can only wonder what he may be doing in our time. What nation is he raising up to punish the United States? Don't rule out the possibility of that, and don't ever entertain the idea that the United States is better than Israel. Probably in the sight of God, we not as well, if I had to guess. It'd only be a guess. Now, the only thing that could have prevented this invasion was repentance and reformation. But they didn't believe that it's going to happen, so they didn't repent, and they didn't reform, and the Chaldeans came and did exactly what was predicted. After all, the Chaldeans had already conquered the mighty Assyrian Empire. They had already made a conquest of Egypt, and now Babylon has become the mistress of the world. So things do not just happen, they're planned. Planned by an all-wise God. And what we call accidents are mere events with God. And history is following a divine timetable. And according to God's time, everything is on time. And you see, Habakkuk thought that the clock had stopped and God had turned his head and looked the other way. And the Lord told him, said, no, said, I'm going to do a work right now and show you that I'm still running the world. He said, just hold on, you'll see what I'm going to do. So you can't deny that in the light of this sixth verse that God was actually arousing the Chaldeans to move them against the nation of Judah. Habakkuk had said God was inactive. In fact, he had already raised up the Babylonians to punish the nation of Judah. So he'd been working all the time. Habakkuk just simply didn't have enough sense to know what he was doing. Now, the latter part of that statement there, to possess dwelling places that are not theirs, simply means that they're not theirs by right, because God gave the land of Canaan to the Israelites. But it's going to be theirs by conquest as long as God wills that it be. And so that's why it says that they will possess the dwellings that are not theirs. And then in verse 7, there's a description of these Chaldeans and of the actions that they will engage in when they come into Judah. they're described in rather terrible terms as an army, if you'll listen to the awful things it said. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity shall proceed of themselves. I would assume the way that verse begins there, that he's telling me that their countenance is going to be fierce, that they'll come in great number, that they'll be wearing shiny armor, and they will have powerful weapons of warfare. Greater weapons of warfare than the nation of Judah possesses. Then in the latter part, he describes some of their actions, says their judgment and their dignity shall proceed out of themselves. They're not going to show any mercy or any pity upon the people. They're not going to spare any pain to man, woman, or child. The law of God will mean absolutely nothing to them. They're not given over to humanitarian ideas. They're going to let their own wills be their law. And so their own wills will be the law they'll abide to. Whatever they want to do, that's what they're going to do. And this power will originate in their own arrogance and pride. So he said, you don't pay any attention to the law of God, so they're not going to pay any attention to it when they come to punish you either. That's a warning against antinomianism, I'd say, right there, when you think about it. Look at the 8th verse. Their horses also are swifter than the leopards, and are more fierce than the evening wolves. And their horsemen shall spread themselves, and their horsemen shall come from far. They shall fly as eagles that hasteneth to eat. So this is quite a description of an invading army. There was one thing remarkable about the horses and men here that are trained for war. In all the history of Israel, they never had a cavalry. Have you ever thought of that? They never had men that rode on horses and fought. They didn't. They were foot soldiers. They never had a cavalry. So any time that they faced one in battle, it was a great astonishment and alarm to them, because they really were not equipped to fight a cavalry. They were foot soldiers. And it was a difficult battle to try to wage against a mighty army of men that were on horses. In other words, they were at a disadvantage. So this within itself would be enough to strike terror to the heart of the people of Judah. After all, just a little small part of the original 12 tribes is all that's left. Just Benjamin and Judah is the only two tribes that Habakkuk is speaking of. The others have already fallen into the hands of the Assyrians a long time before this. And he said that when they come upon these horses, they're going to move faster than the leopards. And they're going to have all of the fierceness of a hungry wolf. He said these soldiers will come upon these horses and they will loot, rape, and kill, and spread panic wherever they go. They'll sweep across the land like an eagle would hasten to the prey when he was very hungry. They're going to come so swift that they'll seem to fly instead of ride upon horses. Well, I can imagine in a nation that didn't have a cavalry, had only foot soldiers, that within itself would about scare man to death. It's amazing how many times in the Bible, and I was astonished today when I looked up all the references, and I'm going to give them all here to you. I'll give you a few of them to go home and think about. When a lot of these invaders came to Israel, that their invasion was compared to that of the flight of an eagle. We read back there a while ago in Deuteronomy 28, 49, and 50 how that this strange nation would come with the flight of an eagle. And in Jeremiah 48 and 40, 49 and 22, Lamentations 4, 19, Ezekiel 17, verse 3, and Daniel 7 and 4, various armies are said to move against Israel and Judah with all the swiftness of an eagle. Strange, but it's a common terminology in the Bible. I had not realized how many times it was mentioned until I really began to run some of the references that are here in my Bible. It is mentioned many times that they would come like that. Then he goes on to describe their invasion and their violence in verse 9. And incidentally, we're going to see there in that ninth verse that God punishes violence with violence. Remember what he complained about? Why God didn't do something about the violence? Look back up there at verse 2 and 3. I'm going to read it again. What's the word violence? O Lord, how long shall I cry, and thou wilt not hear? Even cry unto thee of violence, and thou wilt not save. Why dost thou show me iniquity, and cause me to hold grievance? For spoiling and violence are before me. So then the problem that he saw that surmounted all others was that violence filled the land. Now what's God going to do? He's going to send violence in response to violence. They're going to reap what they sowed. That's God's immutable law. Now listen to verse 9. They shall come all for violence. Coming to people that's been given to violence, now they're going to suffer violence at the hands of their enemies. They shall come all for violence. Their faces shall sup up as the east wind. They shall gather the captivity as the sand. And so the idea that I get when I read that is that every soldier that comes will commit oppression and violence throughout all the land of Judah. You know, there's a funny thing about the east wind in the Bible. Sometime back I brought a sermon on the radio about the wizard of the wind, and I brought out some of that. But the east wind was a terrible wind in Palestine. It would cause the plants to wither and to die. And all kinds of terrible things would happen. You may remember that when old Jonah was under that old gourd vine and he's sitting there up there on the mountainside hoping that the city of Nineveh would be destroyed, like he said, that God sent an east wind and killed his gourd vine. And then he was mad because the gourd vine died. He was a petulant prophet and all that. Anyway, that east wind would cause plants to wither and die if they got too much of it. And so the way that reads there, I get the impression that just as plants wither and die because the east wind is upon them, even so this army will cause men to sink and to die in terror as they approach in this mighty invasion that's about to take place. And then the latter part of that, they shall gather up the captivity as the sand. I think it suggest a great numbers of people that they'll take captive like the grains of sand. But it also suggests that all the fighting of Judah trying to defend themselves will amount to no more than the resistance of the sand to the wind that blows. In other words, they won't be able to defend themselves against their enemies. So they will gather up captives in numbers as the grains of sand and with as little resistance as the sand before the wind. So these invaders are going forth to conquer and to conquer. And nothing that Judah does will even deter them in the least. And then how well that's seen as we get on down to the 10th verse. And there we're told that they're literally going to make fun of Judah's defense. It's going to be like a sort of a funny joke to them. No more defense than they're going to have to offer against their mighty army. And they're going to just pay no attention to kings and princes. And so they're literally going to scoff at the kings of Judah, the princes, the rulers. Make light of them, make fun of them as if they were nothing. And they shall scoff at the kings, and the princes shall be a scorn unto them. They shall deride every stronghold, for they shall heap dust and take it. Well, I think the language here is not very difficult to understand, and that is there's going to be the destruction of the kings and the princes. Now, to let you know what really happened there, you need to go back over here to the book of 2 Chronicles, the 36th chapter, and I'll show you what happened to the last three kings of Judah. And incidentally, at the time that this book was written, Jehoiakim was king. He was followed by Jehoiachin, his son, and then by Zedekiah, who was the last king of Judah. So the kingdom of Judah is near the end in the days of Habakkuk. And every last one of these kings was dealt with severely by the Babylonian invaders. And the record of that can be seen in 2 Chronicles chapter 36. And look what happened there in verse 5 and 6. And Jehoiakim, that's the king in the days of Habakkuk the prophet, was 25 years old when he began to reign. And he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem and did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord his God. Against him came up Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and bound him in fetters to carry him to Babylon. Incidentally, that was the same time that he took golden vessels out of the house of the Lord to Babylon. So in other words, they just literally made fun of the defense of Judah. They completely spoiled that nation when they came. Then you had another king after that. Look in verse 9. And Jehoiakim, that's his son, was 8 years old when he began to reign. And he reigned 3 months and 10 days in Jerusalem. And he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. And when the year was expired, King Nebuchadnezzar sent and brought him to Babylon with the goodly vessels of the house of the Lord and made Zedekiah his brother king over Judah and Jerusalem. Then you can go right on down and find out how that Zedekiah was finally dealt with severely too. And so if you look at all of them, here was Jehoiakim, who was reigning in the time of the prophet Habakkuk. His death was a most terrible thing. They drug him by horses outside the city, like they would drag a dead cow or a dead animal, and they killed him, and the prophet said he had a donkey funeral, to put it in modern words. He had the burial of an ass, is the exact terms in the Bible. We'd probably call it today, he had a donkey funeral. So talk about making fun of the kings and the princes, they did. They gave the king of Judah a donkey funeral and killed him. That's how much attention they paid to him. They had no respect at all for the fact that he was the commander-in-chief of the kingdom of Judah. And the latter part of that suggests how that they'll just laugh at the efforts of the citizens of Judah to defend themselves. And they'll capture a fortress as easy as they would take a little child at play. There'll be nothing to it. After all, if you think about the size of the Babylonian army compared to that little small kingdom of Judah, it'd be about like the state of Ohio trying to fight the Russians and the Chinese if they came over here and attacked this country. It'd be just about that much outnumbered. There was no way they could have defended themselves against these invaders. They were so numerous. They were men of war. And they had already conquered the greatest nation, the Assyrians. They'd already conquered the Egyptians. Now they just looked upon Israel as a small little spot on the map. They just knocked him out of the way in the process. And they certainly did, as history records. Now the 11th verse has some statements in it that are well worth paying attention to. Then shall his mind change, and he shall pass over and offend, imputing this his power unto his God. You know, it's remarkable that they attributed their all of their successes to their gods. The heathens even had enough sense to believe that their gods gave them whatever victories they had. And surely every victory that this country has ever had has been because the Lord, our God, gave it to us. Whether it be the Second World War or the First World War, it was God that gave us the victory. That victory, while was certainly due to a lot of brave men and brave women that fought and died, it was God that enabled this country to survive as a free republic. We must never lose sight of that fact. You know, you say, well, now, why did God let this mean nation come over there and just loot and burn the whole kingdom of Judah? His own chosen people, his own covenant people. Why did he let them be dealt with that way? Because they wouldn't listen to what he said. And he chastised them with the rod of men. And the men happened to be the Babylonians. So they attributed the success probably, I don't know whether to Baal or to Nebo. They worshipped both gods in Babylon and many more than that. But the more common god was Baal. They probably attributed it to Baal, if I had to suppose. Now the funny thing is, when you look at that 11th verse, that the king of Babylon didn't know that God was using him. He didn't know God was using him. He thought he was just out there in conquest. But God was using him all the time. So wicked men and wicked nations do not know that they are fulfilling the preordained plan of God, but they are. Now they're ignorant of God's ways, and they wouldn't believe that they're doing anything of the kind. I think about the statement about Cyrus over there in the book of Isaiah, chapter 44 and the beginning of chapter 45. The Lord called him by name a long, long time before he was ever born. And he said, "You're my shepherd. You'll perform all of my pleasure. You'll say to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built," and so on. And then he goes on down, and just in the latter part of that 45th chapter there, he says, "You'll do all of this, though thou hast not known me." So he didn't know God. He didn't know he was fulfilling the will of God. But he was. Those 10 kings in Revelation 17:17, they're not going to know they're fulfilling the will of God, but they are. And Judas Iscariot probably didn't know that he was carrying out the predetermined plan of God when he sold the Lord for 30 pieces of silver, but the prophet had already said that it would be that way. Prophet Zechariah did hundreds of years before that time. So God sometimes uses people that don't know that he's using them. They're acting according to their own desires and wishes. But they're carrying out the secret will and decree of God. And in many cases, to punish his people. So, well, now, why did he let the Babylonians do this? Because they were ripe for judgment, and he wanted them to get worse and worse so that his judgment would come against them. Do you know that this very man that was so severe upon Judah, he just about said he was a god? You don't think he made a powerful statement one time? Listen to what he said over here in the book of Daniel, chapter 4, and verse 30. "The king spake and said, Is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house and kingdom by the might and my power and for the honor of my majesty?" No wonder the Lord struck him down with the canopy. He thought he was a beast of the field and went out and lived like an animal for a while. Men make a statement like that, boasting and bragging, his pride certainly ought to bring him to destruction. And that haughty spirit ought to experience a fall, and it did. So really what God is doing, he's letting the Chaldeans increase their sin of self-deification that he may ultimately judge them by the Medo-Persian Empire that will overthrow the Babylonian Empire at a later time. Now there are a few general facts that we need to point out here. God does permit a particular evil to go unpunished temporarily because he's working on a much larger plan than what we know about. One man said, "God does not settle all of his accounts the first of the month." And that's right. He settles them, but not all at one time, you see. That's what the man meant. So he works on a different timetable than what man knows anything about. That's why we don't understand what God's doing. That's why sometimes we say, "Well, God, why don't you do something?" He is. We just don't understand what he is doing, you see. But God never does work by our standards. And a finite man can never recognize the work of an infinite God. So therefore, God is always at work. He is the Lord of history. We must believe that he's doing right even when it appears that he's doing wrong. Now, I suppose if I had lived in Judah in that time and this mighty army had come and all this devastation had taken place, I probably would have went around and hung my head like most people did and said, "Lord, why didn't you let it happen to us? What did we do?" Well, he'd been warning them of the prophets for years and nobody wouldn't listen. So we might raise a few questions here at the end of this lesson. Has God been warning us as a people here in America for years and years, and have we listened, or have we failed to listen? And if so be that we have not listened, then what nation is God today, fierce and mighty people, is he raising up to punish us for our sins? I tell you, we better take warning. America is not any better than Israel, not any better than Judah. So we better take warning. Let us stand.